From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Aki Takurtha.
And I'm Clara Izupidis.
This week on War News Radio, Voices of Change, we first hear about the trial of former President Hosni Mubarak and other post-revolution developments in Egypt.
Then, we look into the unemployment crisis plaguing Iraqi refugees now in America. But first, a roundup of this week's news.
According to Libyan rebels, 27-year-old Khamis Gaddafi, son of Muammar Gaddafi, was killed by a NATO airstrike in the western town of Zliten. NATO did not confirm the death reports, saying that Alliance strikes targeted an ammunition depot and military police facility 90 miles southeast of Tripoli. According to a spokesperson for the rebel leadership, Gaddafi was among the 32 troop members killed when NATO forces hit a government operations center early on Friday morning. This is not the first time that Khamis Gaddafi has been reported dead. In March, rumors circulated that he had been killed in a previous airstrike. However, he was shown, days later, on state television. While NATO is investigating the matter further, the Libyan government denies this current report.
The Iraqi government has decided to begin negotiations with the United States about extending a U.S. military presence beyond the end of the scheduled December 2011 withdrawal date. After 4 hours of talks between the two countries, all leaders of parliament's blocs, except for the Sadrists, followers of anti-American Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, agreed that keeping a U.S. training mission in the country for Iraqi forces would be beneficial. Throughout the discussion of extending the deadline, Iraqi politicians have expressed concern over Iraq's security with neighboring countries, especially with Iran. 44,000 U.S. troops are currently deployed in Iraq. The number that will remain has yet to be discussed.
Payanda Khan, the head of a National Directorate of Security in Afghanistan's Kunduz province, was killed by a roadside bomb. The explosion wounded 3 local children, but authorities reported no additional deaths. Khan's assassination is the latest in a series of high-profile assassinations in Afghanistan.
Former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak faced day one of his trial this week in Cairo, charged with ordering the unlawful killing of protesters during the 18 days of demonstrations against him. He is also charged with economic corruption for a deal he is accused of having made with Israel on gas exports. Mubarak was brought into the cage, a barred entrapment typical in Egyptian courtrooms, on a hospital stretcher due to his alleged health problems. He denied all charges. Mubarak's 2 sons, former Minister of the Interior, and 6 of his senior police deputies are also on trial for similar charges. At the end of the session, Mubarak's trial was adjourned until August 15th. The trial was televised nationally, representing a historical moment for Egypt. Noha Radwan, a native Egyptian and professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California at Davis, says,
"Everybody is elated. Everybody feels that justice is going to take its course."
After the break, Eliana Biscard Church takes a more in-depth look at the significance of the trial and other political changes in Egypt.
Is War News Radio. The world has watched the Arab Spring with fascination as protests fell like dominoes across the Middle East, beginning in Tunisia. These protesters have called for political change, and one country in particular is showing that the people can implement their voices. Eliana Biscard Church looks into the beginning political changes in Egypt, what is occurring and what still needs to be done, and the power of the people to make it so.
On February 11th, after protests for just 1 month, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak relinquished power to the army. About 5 months later, Mubarak currently stands trial on the charges of ordering the killing of anti-government protesters and of corruption. The Egyptian movement for political change is speeding forward.
I hope that this teaches people everywhere that with peaceful protest, the masses can force their will on the minority that holds the power.
That's Noha Radwan, a professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California at Davis and a native Egyptian. Before our interview, Radwan had stayed up till 5 a.m. watching the televised live trial of Mubarak, lying on a hospital stretcher in a cage in white jail uniform, by Al Jazeera. The demands of the mass protest to topple Mubarak succeeded in bringing him to trial, and Egyptians also can look forward to the first free democratic parliamentary and presidential elections in their country. They are the beginning of a democratic process in Egypt. But in a country with largely viewed state-controlled media, a wide gap in the distribution of wealth, and a governing force using military tribunals for dissenters, more change is needed to support political progress, even before the elections begin. Radwan has a list.
I think there has to be some law that prevents people from buying votes. This is especially important in Egypt because the difference between the rich and the poor is huge. Poor people who have not even enough to live on are very susceptible and vulnerable to that kind of practice.
Radwan also says that sectarian discourse is much too prevalent in political rhetoric. She thinks it is necessary to remove language indicating intolerance towards religious groups, especially Christians, and argues that Egypt needs to move towards a political discourse of equal civil rights and duties for all. Finally, she believes the threat of military tribunals is another major problem that needs to be fixed.
Right now, we have over 1,000 people who are facing military tribunals and being held in prison or in custody based on military tribunals that they already faced. And one of the demands of the people who had been demonstrating was that civilians need not and should not face military tribunals. And of course, if we go through the elections with this possibility of military tribunals in place, any person who objects to the procedures could face military tribunals being taken off by the military, and then we don't know what happens to them.
Dina Ibrahim, Associate Professor of Broadcasting and Electronic Communication Arts at San Francisco State University and also a native Egyptian, sees the tribunals as a threat to forming democracy as well. When we spoke, she was preparing to leave for Egypt, where she would be training Egyptian journalists, both state-employed and independent, to cover the elections, specifically on techniques to support democratic change. She sees the tribunals as a threat to Egyptians' freedom of expression and to the media's ability to cover the elections in a balanced way.
Basically, the biggest challenge is to try and overcome this notion of fear, because people are afraid at the end of the day to really express their views freely. You know, the army has also been going after bloggers and various other independent journalists, for example, for criticizing the army. So people have to still be very careful about what they say.
Due to the low literacy rates in Egypt, the majority of people get their news from state TV. Other media outlets include state radio and government newspapers, although there is also an independent press. Part of Ibrahim's goal in training journalists is to help the state-produced media become more balanced. The biggest issue, she says, though, is the fact that there has been little coverage of the elections because the country has been so wrapped up in the trials of Mubarak, his sons, and the former Minister of the Interior.
There hasn't been enough time for people to really understand who the candidates are and what they stand for, because we've been so obsessed with corruption trials that people simply aren't armed with enough information to make a sound political choice. The latest poll that I saw essentially said that the vast majority of Egyptians, like over 60%, have no idea how they're going to vote.
Radwan thinks that the candidates and parties, while still too vaguely outlined in the media, are beginning to take shape. The parliamentary elections are set for October 2011. The three major contenders, she says, are the Socialist Democratic Coalition and the Egyptian Democratic Nationalist Party, both liberal parties, and then the Freedom and Justice Party, or the Muslim Brotherhood. The Supreme Council of Armed Forces recently announced the voting system for the parliamentary elections. Half of the seats will be chosen by voters in each district, who can pick individual candidates, like in the U.S. system, and to determine the other half, each voter will also pick a political party. The political parties will then get seats according to a proportional share of these total votes, as many other countries do to ensure minority parties are represented. Meanwhile, the presidential elections are set for November 2011. Ibrahim explains the important role the media has in the elections.
This is a brand new situation. This is the first free and fair election in Egypt's 5,000-year history. And so I think that the media have a responsibility to the public. They really need to make the issues clear and not get distracted by sensationalist elements of the election, so that when people come to vote, they feel like they're empowered with information about not just the candidates and who they are, but actually where they stand on critical social and economic issues.
She will try and make this possible.
We're basically trying to change entire ways of thinking when it comes to the role of the press, from essentially being a government mouthpiece to serving the public, and also being able to include and respect all different points of view, including ones that are unpopular.
In order to prevent these problems before the election, Radwan believes that people may need to, again, step up, protest, and make the demands. She points out that the success of the Egyptian movement has been seen by the army's willingness to listen to the masses, and so the people should continue to exercise their power. They are on a long upward swing, and now Mubarak's trial has spirits high, as video from Al Jazeera and Democracy Now! Have shown, with Egyptians celebrating the trial in the streets. Radwan explains that this is a profound moment for the country.
It's also a major accomplishment. A movement needs to be sustained by victories, big and small. And ousting Mubarak was a victory. Bringing him to trial is another victory. And it keeps the movement sustained. Because otherwise people can start to feel like, well, we're actually accomplishing nothing.
There may be victories, but Radwan still believes change is needed before the election, as with the military tribunals and payoff voting, as well as after the election. She says a constitution with equal civil rights built in, as well as a governmental system of checks and balances and accountability, are necessary. Lastly, she believes Egypt's stratified population needs to be evened out.
We need to close the gap between the rich and poor in Egypt, and we need to have a much better educated Egyptian public, because, you know, a democracy really is a system that works best with the middle class. And with more than 40% of the Egyptians living below poverty line, you know, a representative government will be less than desirable until this problem is solved.
Radwan and Ibrahim both understand that Egypt is still in a transition period. The elections have already been postponed, and the media talks of further delays. Radwan and Ibrahim agreed that later elections might enable Egyptians to better prepare for voting. However, they also both said that holding them too late could cause a number of problems. Both women spoke of the economic costs of a country held in limbo, and Radwan expressed concern over the army feeling too comfortable in a position of power. Of course, the status of the elections remained to be seen, and though Radwan and Ibrahim know there is much work to be done in the country, it is obvious that Egyptians are still thirsty for change. Radwan sees the people as the ultimate wielders of power in Egypt.
And I think true democracy will be protected by the people, the masses, that is. We're talking about 80 million Egyptians who need to, at some point, feel that they benefited from the political change that happened in Egypt. Once they feel the change, and it would affect them, for example, if we have more social equity after the election extended to the 80 million Egyptians, to the masses, then they would be the protectors of democracy in the future. When things go wrong, they can voice their opposition. They can have the right to object.
The last 5 months, and now Mubarak's trial, show that Egyptians are ready to take on this role. Mubarak's trial is rescheduled for August 15th. The rest of the world looks on in excitement. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
This is War News Radio. When fleeing a war zone and hoping to live in a safe land whose streets are paved with gold, the last thing refugees expect to worry about is the lack of career opportunities in America. Dina Sherhan, reports on the crisis of unemployment among Iraqi refugee communities in the U.S.
After running away from the 2003 war and its aftermath of violence and persecution, millions of Iraqis have scattered around the world, according to the International Rescue Committee. Ongoing strife and devastation in Iraq have prevented most from returning home safely. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, 64,834 Iraqi refugees have been admitted to the U.S. since the outbreak of the war. According to the July 2011 Department of State Database for Refugee Resettlement in the U.S., Iraqis had not been fleeing in large numbers from their home country until February 2006. That is when sectarian violence escalated in response to the bombing of Al-Askari Mosque in the city of Samarra. Most of those refugees were then resettled in the U.S. in June 2007, with a total of 59,828 Iraqis resettled during the fiscal years of 2007 to 2011.
Well, as any other refugee group in the current economy, refugee group or actually local Americans as well, employment has been, people have been having troubles in finding employment. If you take into consideration the challenges that newly arrived refugees deal with, lack of speaking English, lack of experience in the United States, then you can consider the factors that would probably increase that.
That was Leila Dersanova, Director of Development and Communication at the Nationality Service Center. NSC is a nonprofit organization that provides social, educational, senior, translational, and legal services to immigrants and refugees in the greater Philadelphia area. Each year, they help approximately 4,000 individuals from over 90 countries, including Iraq. Once in the U.S., Iraqis face new difficulties during their adjustment period. One of the most common problems has been with high rates of unemployment, with many families unable to secure meaningful work and living in poverty. According to a recent report by Reuters News Agency, unemployment rates among Iraqi refugees are estimated at nearly three times the U.S. national average of 9%. Dersanova explains that it is essential for Iraqi refugees to find any job during their first 4 months in the U.S.
It's very important for refugees when they just arrived to the country to get a job, to get that experience of working in the U.S., and it doesn't mean that they will stay in this job for a long time. They might or not, but this will be a first step. This will be something that will be a good kind of a step towards, getting yourself established in the U.S., learning about the U.S. work culture.
But it is not always possible for refugees to meet this challenge. In addition to the economic hardships, which are affecting many in the U.S., refugees deal with other challenges that make their job-hunting journey even more difficult, including linguistic and cultural barriers. Jonathan Lucas is the National Coordinator for Refugees Works in Baltimore, an agency consultant for the federal government to help refugees around the country become self-sufficient. He talks about the difficult situation refugees confront when looking for a job.
So many of American-born folks are out of work that there's a greater competition for the jobs that are out there, and that translates into employers being able to be a lot more picky. So once there was a job where English language, the ability would be a mid-level ability to speak that language, all of a sudden employers are asking for near fluency. And so that really hurts our population of refugees, especially Iraqis too, who may, are still working to become fluent in English. It's just a greater competition overall.
Lucas adds that most of newly arrived Iraqi refugees come in with advanced education and experience, making it even more difficult to meet their job preferences.
A lot of times they have higher expectations because of their prior experience, and they're looking for a higher level of job or something that matches their skill sets a lot more closely. And for those people, I've worked with a lot of doctors and engineers and lawyers and teachers, and very highly qualified, but still don't meet the U.S. standards a lot of times in these fields.
Aliyah Sarraf is a law student at the University of Southern California. He is the president of the USC chapter of the Iraqi Refugee Assistance Project. IRAP is an American organization that supports Iraqis who have been displaced by the sectarian violence in the aftermath of the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. the difficulties affecting the blue-collar sector vary from those faced by professionals.
The problem for the professional sector is actually recertification. So you have a lot of doctors or dentists who are coming here and their degrees are not recognized. And so they have to go back through their recertification process and get the proper degrees to practice here in the United States. So that's a very expensive and time-consuming route that doesn't allow a lot of them to just kind of jump in and practice from in the field that they were previously in.
On the blue-collar level, Asraf says Iraqi refugees are mostly affected by the dire economic situation, as well as the lack of proper English skills required for this kind of jobs.
I can give you an example. I know I have a friend who I'd met in Jordan, who's an Iraqi refugee, who came over and is now in Aurora, Illinois. And he was working at a factory over there where the voluntary agencies had set up for many Iraqi refugees. They had set up positions working in the factory. Several months later, they actually fired all of them due to, you know, budget cuts and kind of the bad economy.
A U.S. Government Accountability Office report released in March 2010 also explains that qualified Iraqi refugees have the most trouble obtaining U.S. government employment. Most federal positions require U.S. citizenship and background investigations. Most Arabic-speaking positions also require security clearance. According to officials from the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, OPM, it is difficult to complete background investigations on Iraqi refugees. For example, it is difficult to obtain the information necessary to verify Iraqi refugees' employment history. According to the report, Iraqi refugees are eligible for resettlement assistance and public benefits upon arrival in the United States. However, if refugees don't find employment, support may continue for up to 90 days. After the maximum period of 90 days is through, Iraqi refugees are on their own, and the Department of State takes no further responsibility for their resettlement. Ali Asraf explains that if Iraqi refugees cannot find jobs when the eligible federal aid comes to an end, most families look to their local communities for help.
I mean, the hope is that by that time they have a job that they can support their family with. That's not always the case. A lot of times they get assistance from the community around them, either, you know, donated cars or usually the house is a donated house or a much cheaper rent that they would have to pay than market price. And so those are some of the ways that they can help the situation. But at the end of the day, obviously they do need some cash inflow in order to get by. And so for families that don't have jobs, I mean, I think they definitely look to the community, whether it's the Iraqi community or just the local community where they're living, to get assistance.
However, the help is not always available. And so, high unemployment rates among the Iraqi refugee communities have been translating into poverty and homelessness, as some Iraqi refugees face eviction because they cannot pay their rent. All these factors are causing many Iraqi refugees to consider leaving the U.S. for other countries. According to the same recent Reuters report, more than 2,000 Iraqis have left the U.S. over the past 4 years. Those who choose to return home are faced with many challenges, including a lack of security, limited prospects for their livelihoods, and poor social services. However, Asraf says that leaving for Iraq or any other Middle Eastern country is not an option to many of those refugees.
I haven't had any personal experiences with that have actually come here and then moved other places. I've spoken with several who have just talked about the difficulties and how it's not a complete escape from the problems that they face in the Middle East. And I mean, the problem is that they're pretty much stuck between a rock and a hard place because they face persecution or they face, I mean, the unemployment rate in the Middle East is even higher than it is here.
With only limited support available, many Iraqis are left to choose between possible persecution in their home country or poverty anywhere else. For War News Radio, I'm Dina Sherhan.
This is War News Radio. Before we let you go, we wanted to introduce you to one of our interns from this summer. As an intern, Sarah Dwyder spent 10 weeks reporting for War News Radio full-time. I sat down with her to talk to her about her experience here. So, Sarah, could you just introduce yourself to our listeners today?
Well, I'm Sarah Dwyder. I'm from Westfield, New Jersey, and I'm a rising junior here at Swarthmore College. And I'm studying Middle Eastern Studies and Art History.
So why did you want to get involved with War News Radio?
Well, with Middle Eastern Studies, I'm really interested in anything to do with the Middle East, and I thought it would be a great opportunity to talk to people actually living there and hear about their experiences.
So what sort of experiences did you get to hear about?
Well, I interviewed the director of the Museum of Modern Art in Iraq, which was really exciting, and a couple of artists, actually, who were living there and got to hear about the artist community post-invasion. And I also got to talk to someone who ran a tour bus service in Afghanistan and the kind of tourists who are popping up in Afghanistan these days.
Throughout your time here this summer, did you have a favorite piece that you worked on?
Well, I think it was definitely the tourism piece. It was really, really interesting to even interview people who went to Afghanistan just to see the nature. It was a really different side of the conflict that you don't really hear every day.
What about a show? Did you have a favorite show too?
Oh, well, there was the week that President Obama announced the drawdown of American troops in Afghanistan. Here at the studio, all of the interns, Dina Sharhan and Clara Zepidis and Eliana Biscard Church and Stuart Russell and I, just dropped everything to find interviews about the troop drawdown and hear different sides of the issue. So that was really exciting. A lot of frantic phone calls and last minute show work, but it was really exciting.
So what do we have to look forward to, both from you and from War News Radio in the future?
Well, we have some great shows for the month of August that we've already put together, and I have a piece about Iraqi protests in there that should be pretty interesting. So listen in for the next few weeks.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. I appreciate you talking to me today.
Yeah, no problem.
For War News Radio, I'm Clara Izupidis. That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Sarah Dwyder, Eliana Biscard Church, and Dina Sharhan. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Clara Izupidis.
And I'm Anki Tikritha. Until next time, thanks for listening.